Nā te mea tuatahi e whae papatuanuku, tēnā koe, tēnā koe nā ohuana e whakamahana ngā mokapuna. E rangi, kia ora. E rangi e tū iho nei, tēnā koe. Tēnā whare, he whare tapu, mihi mai, mihi mai. Kia koutou katoa, ngā mihi aroha, kia koutou, kua tai mai nei ki te tautoko, tēnei kaupapa. Ko Elizabeth Kerekere tōko ingoa, he mokupuna au o te tai rāwhiti. Ko whānau ākai, ko Ngāti Oneone, ko te aitanga Mahaki, ko Rongo Whakaata me ngai tāmanuhiri o kunei iwi. So I descend from the tribes of Central Gisborne, and that's on my father's side. On my mother's side, I hail from County Clare and County Tipperary in Ireland. I'm really, really honoured to be here today because Wairua spirituality is an absolute core to who I am and what I do in the world. So I'm very, very happy to be amongst those of you who feel the same way. I want to thank the organisers for inviting me. Kia ora to Craig, and I'm sure there are many others that have done a lot of work to make this happen, but the ones I've dealt with are Craig, and a particular shout out to Neil, because many years ago when I was running the Queer Youth Project for what was then at the AIDS Foundation, we did a youth leadership national training hui, and Neil was one of the young people there, and so I am so proud of all the things that you've done ever since. So, I normally talk about politics and about the things we have to do in the community, but today I wanted to make it much more personal. I wanted to share some parts of my life and I guess how that's impacted of who I am and the work that I do now. So, now that I've had a lot, I'm much better and learnt more about languaging. I used to say that I had a schizophrenic upbringing. And what I meant by it was that there were many aspects of my life, because of the way my parents brought me up, where things were just diametrically opposite. And so definitely in spirituality it was so. My mother persuaded my father that the best schools were Catholic schools, and my mother was Catholic. And so she absolutely aced the Catholic guilt trip thing. One of her superpowers. Every now and then something will happen and I feel it welling up inside me and I just look at someone and go, I am so disappointed in you right now. And I know it's from my mother. she persuaded my father that because they did the best education, and he cared very deeply about education, I'm one of the few people amongst my wider cousins that was able to go and stay at school instead of having to go and work as soon as they could. And so we went to Catholic schools. The problem with that is we were in Dunedin, and it was a very, very racist town. And I'm pretty fair now, but regardless of our colour, we stood out. And we'd just recently moved from Gisborne down to Dunedin, and we were hassled a lot by teachers, by other students, and we were routinely called Hories, was the term at the time. And the nuns would hit us on the head with Bibles, and I think there's a lot wrong with that. So just to quickly pick that apart, A, I think you shouldn't be hitting children at all in school, at all. But that was, you know, that was a standard part of Catholic schooling at the time. You know, wrapping the knuckles, getting the strap, all those things were normal. But it seemed to me to be disrespecting the Bible, surely, to be using it as a weapon. And so I found that. So I'm going to these schools, which theoretically are the best place for me to learn, but they're treating me and my knowledge and my family and where I came from with complete disrespect. And so if I talked about more spiritual things or things that my grandmother had told me, and they would make fun of me, all the time. But at the same time, my father was teaching me about the old Māori gods, about Papatūānuku, our Mother Earth, Rangi Nui, our Sky Father, my favourite, Hina Moana, who was the ocean. And there was an incident that happened when I was just a baby. My dad would take me and we'd have snuggles in the room, but he was a drinker and he would sometimes fall asleep, and a smoker. And one time he fell asleep with me and left a smoke in the pillow beside me. And they were having something to eat and saw smoke coming out from under the door. And they walked in and the entire bed was on fire. And I was sitting in the middle of the bed, just watching, transfixed by the flames. And it wasn't until many years later that someone who works a lot with around Atua and our gods, that they said, so Mahuika, our goddess of fire, they said Mahuika touched you, she protected you. And so I've been obsessed with fire my whole life. And again, it wasn't until someone pointed out to me, they go, oh, there you go, drawing fire all the time, and I'd never noticed. And then I look back through all my artwork and it's like, oh, I see what you're talking about. And so those things then, having experienced that as a baby, and I remember the flames, and I was just little. And also, don't do that. I don't need to pick that apart, you know. It's like, and so I had this thing where I'm going to school, and we were Dominican nuns. They were full on, full habit, full gears. And when we first turned up in school, and the flying nun, very big on TV at that time, and so we totally asked them, were they the flying nuns? And they quite seriously told us, sorry, but that was another order in another church down the road. And so I was like, honestly, I went home and I was going, we might be able to go and meet them, they're just down the road. But, and yet, there were some nuns who were amazing, who absolutely saw the spark inside of us and realised this was someone who loved to learn and absolutely nurtured that. So I don't have an entirely negative view of having grown up, but it was just, I'm learning these really beautiful things over here based on my marae, and that whenever we went home, the first thing we did before we met any living person, we went to our family urupā. And not just one, we went to a few in a row, and we'd sit there and my dad would talk about his mum, his grandmother, his great-grandfather, and tell me stories about those people. So I always felt really connected. The other aspect is that he brought me up to listen to our ancestors, and that's, you practice that by going to the urupā, by sitting by their graves and talking to them. When I was a young person, I would hitchhike from Dunedin to Gisborne if I had a big decision to make, and I would sit down by the grave of my grandmother, who I was named after, and I would ask her advice. That's how so ingrained it was. Now, I'd stay with a mate and hitchhike all the way back again. And so I'm always thankful for all the craziness, and there was much of it, that he gave me that connection through to them. The other thing he did was that we all grew up interpreting our dreams, because he said most of the time people are too constrained in their thinking and it's hard for our ancestors to get through, so they talk to us in our dreams. So we learned from a very young age to listen to those, to interpret them, and to then decide how we're going to behave because of it. And just the core thing, though, was to believe in them, to believe. And so I had this going on while we had this thing with school. I was in Catholic school all the way up till seventh form, which is, what do they call it now, year 13? And always on a track to university. I was one of the few people in my family still to go there. But I knew from a very young age, that's where I was going to go. My father had very high expectations of me, so he always said that I would go and learn things so I could bring those back to my family and help my people. And I never knew what that would look like. And he would also, from the age of 12, he would introduce me to his friends as the first Māori Prime Minister. So always, again, with the expectations. But he would set that as like, that's a normal thing. And so there's a part of me that just goes, oh, well, must be true. So in the back of my mind, it's always been a thing of, no matter what I did, no matter how my path was going, that somewhere in the back of my mind, there was something there. And I understand that many of you who were at the opening last night, you saw the film about the Rainbow Room and went in that space, and you saw my artwork that's in there. And I felt I created that work in 2012. And so there's I believe that's Wairua, that's spirituality working, that it guides me so that it's holding space until I could get there and do some serious work. Because, you know, I didn't come here to muck around. I don't. When I moved to Wellington, and I was very involved in lesbian, which was primarily at the time lesbian gay communities, but I was also around the other Māoris who were whakawahine, and who were queer. And I was really aware that there was a thing in our community that was, when you come here, you're just this. You're lesbian, you're gay, and your culture actually doesn't matter. And so I struggled with that because it was so fundamental to me. Actually, I'm going to come back to this. There's one other story I need to tell you that's really important about when I was young, growing up Catholic. Was when I was 10, my grandmother passed away, and she was the absolute love of my life. I cry more for her than I have ever cried for my father. Sorry, Dad. But when she passed away, I came back to school, and we had this, because we had religious education. If there are other people here grown up in Catholic schools, then you'll know every single day, religious, we start. And I said about my grandmother had died, and they were going, was she Catholic? And I said, no. And they said, oh, that's sad, she's going to hell. Again, don't do that. I was upset, I was devastated, and that's what they came back with, because of course, and that was the running joke at the time. When anybody went to heaven, St. Peter's would take them in, and you'd see this huge wall, and they were going, what's over there? And they said, shh, it's the Catholics, they think they're the only ones here. As a young 10-year-old who'd had 5 years of Catholic education by that stage, that said, if you are not, and I argued with them as a 10-year-old, I argued with the rest of my class and my teachers and the nuns, and I said, what if she lived the life of Jesus? She was an incredibly kind woman, generous, beautiful, like all of us kids felt like each of us was her favorite. What if she lived the values of Jesus? This is a 10-year-old fighting for the memory of my grandmother, and they said it's not enough. If she's not Catholic, she's going to hell. And in that moment, I said, if that's what your church thinks, I will never be Christian. And so at 10 years old, I sat there and I cried through the rest of that class. But in that moment, I said, I will never, ever be involved in organized religion again. And then they had to put up with me. This is the real seeds of my activism. They had to put up with me for 6 more years, every single morning, challenging every single thing that they said. So, bringing it back to here, it was the late 80s, early 90s when I came here. And in 90, It was several years of working in the community, doing my thing, and there were lots of issues bubbling up. There was a thing about culture, about whether it was okay to, because it's like, oh, you're not Māori now, we're just all lesbian. And it's always felt weird. It's like, why should I cut off the whole half of who I am? Or actually not half, this is all of who I am. And those things should weave together, but for some people could not conceive of that. And I'm thankful for subsequent research that says for Māori, for Pacific Island people, and I'd imagine many people of colour, that says actually your culture, our spirituality as is as important to us as our sexuality and gender. And so I formed Te Whana Whana in 2001, founded that. Many of you will know them. They opened, not much happens in this region without Te Whana Whana. And that was years and years of building relationships in our community to say, actually, kaupapa Māori, tikanga, Māori ways of doing things can easily be an integrated part of our rainbow communities. And in that case, all of us can feel welcome and included. And so we thought that we did that, not beating people around the head and with Bibles or any other items, because not effective. It is not an effective way to persuade people, but just connecting with people so that we could share, have a shared vision of what we wanted to see in the world. And gradually we built up our influence, and so we made a decision very early on not to be funded by government, so we could never be constrained by funding obligations, and that all the projects we've done and the resources that Neil referred to, other people got funding and we had strong relationships with them. I'd write things and we'd work things together and then produce them, because it needed to work for all of our communities. When we were going through the politics, and I don't know if some of you were around, but we would have women's dances or we'd have lesbian dances at the time, and there were all these issues about people who identified as bisexual or identified as queer, because the words lesbian and gay did not fit what they were about. And so then people who were in relationships with someone who was bisexual, for example, wouldn't be allowed to go to a lesbian event. And so all these things started happening. And then this language started happening. And shout out to our bisexual, pansexual whānau, because how excruciating it must be to have other people talking about your sexuality and trying to contain it and define it without talking to you about it. It's shameful. But in the way that it was interpreted, they would say, oh, if a bisexual woman is with a woman, they're in a lesbian relationship. But if they're with a man, they're straight. And that was the narrative for a long time, in the 90s especially. Instead of just saying, actually, they are bisexual all of the time, in every relationship that they're in. And now that simple thing, that shouldn't be so hard for people to understand, but also none of their business. I would watch these things happening and thinking, how do we keep, kind of build the unity across our communities, but keep having those conversations? One of my friends I want to shout out to, Pere Te Wao, it was the first person I was around while they went through their transition. And several other people that we knew were transitioning. They were assigned female at birth and became the men they knew themselves to be. But when it was through talking with Piri, I realised that it's our wairua that drives our sexuality and gender. It's something inside us that knows, that allows us to know who we are. And because wairua, the interconnectedness of all things in the universe. And I really, really believe that from the gods, from our ancestors, this wairua that exists beyond death, it goes out into the world and we have it for the time we're here. That is the thing that drives us. That drives a little child to know from 3 or 4 years of age exactly what their gender is. These gender reveal parties, revolting. I say, why don't you wait a few years and let the child tell you what their gender is instead of pushing this binary thing on them? And so, but through talking to Piri, I realised, because there were some things and I was getting caught up with the technical things, or and people were saying, you're not trans unless you've had surgery, and I didn't understand all the issues. But as soon as he said Wairua, it's like, that I understand. And I thought, that is how I can help explain it to our people. Because for many of us, we are accepted inside our whānau, but for many of us are not. And if you don't have the supports around and your friends and support agencies, you know, when we were young, there were no youth groups, unless it was our groups of mates that tried to keep each other safe. There was not the internet. We wrote letters to each other to communicate. I don't know how, as young people, we organised National Hui purely by letter, because it was too expensive to make toll calls. Like, the planning, I'm thankful for the skill. But yes, now I watch it and say, oh my God, so much easier. Then it's just different issues you have to deal with. But Wairua, that thing that tells us who we are, that drives us to express ourselves into a world, though, that feels they need to tell us who we are, that wants to contain us, that wants to so powerfully and adamantly hold on to this binary story of the world, but which has never, ever been true. And such a colonial construct, because Indigenous people all over the world, had two or more genders, always had more than one, always had more than two, I mean, always had many, but also an acceptance, a normal part of their culture, including for Māori, that we could be fluid, that we could decide who we want to love and share our body with. And for Māori, as long as we got on with our work, as long as we got our jobs done, as long as we contributed to the survival of our people. And part of the confidence I have around the work I do with Takatāpui is when I was 16 and I decided, I'd found the word lesbian and decided that applied to me, and I knew from when I was 11 that I liked girls. I hitchhiked again from Dunedin to talk to my great-grandmother, who was born in 1903. It was very hard to explain to her what a lesbian was. She had never heard the word. I had to say that I would like to have a girlfriend, and she goes, I've got girlfriends. I had to say to my great-grandmother, who was in her late 70s at that time, that I would like to find a girl that might want to have sex with me. And she just did not bat an eyelid. Did not bat an eyelid. She goes, oh yes, I had aunties like that. And I was like, oh my God, this is big. And I was like, what do you mean? What do you tell me about this? And she said her aunties had lived together as couples. And this was in Te Puke, where she grew up. And they had to have been born at the absolute latest in the late 1880s. And they were living as couples. And so from there, that has given me always the absolute strength to claim this space. And when I said to her, what did you call them? What name did you have for them? And she said, we didn't have a name. They were just part of the whānau. So all my resources, my thesis, all the research I do is saying, we're part of the whānau. When the Greens, we had our placards for the march that we had this morning, said trans people are whānau. And that, it was like, because it was just normal. The fact that they were living as women together, not a thing, not a special name, just whānau. And that just gave me absolute steel. I was brought up to be staunch. I was brought up to be confident and to lead. But that was like anybody trample on the mana of anybody in our communities, you're trampling on our gods, on our ancestors. But you tell me as a Māori that our people weren't like this. Now you're trampling on the memory of my great-grandmother, and I will not put up with it. And I think it's really, really important for those of us with conviction to always then hold space, open space for people who are still trying to find it. As part of my work, I've kind of, since I found the word takatāpui, when I was through the research of Ngahuia Te Awe Kōtuku and Lee Smith, they both found it in the late 70s in the work of Te Rangi Kāheke, the first Māori to start writing manuscripts. And so we're back in the 1830s for this. And the very first story that was put into writing, the story of Hinemoa and Tutanekai, the greatest love story, which of course we know was kind of a three-way story, because Tutanekai was already in a relationship with Tiki, his best friend, his partner, his hoa takatāpui. And so when people talk about sometimes want to claim that we had identities back in the day, or that we were celebrated back in the day, and I always have to say we were not, we were just normal. We didn't always need special words, and even the word takatāpui was a term of endearment. So like whaiai, poor sweetheart, my love, that was the name for same sex. And I believe that there are many more names out there that we will eventually find. And so when I found that term, a term that brought together my culture, my spirituality, but also my diversity into one thing, it's like, oh, we must all have this. And so I have dedicated my life since the mid-80s, since especially the 90s, since I came home in the 2000s when we formed Te Whanawhana. And our goal is to advocate for takatāpui, to tell our stories, build our communities, and leave a legacy. I have a strict rule that any time I get asked to talk on this topic, I will always say yes. Our goal is to take takatāpui to the world, because I believe as Māori and the way that we can live our culture and our spirituality, then that is a gift. That we have a strength that we have. And if we can support other Indigenous people, any other people around the world, to help strengthen their confidence, give them ideas of ways to operate, how to build relationships, then we will always do that. And so, again, thank you for having me here. In my thesis, now, I was asked to do a PhD from one of our kuia, who was takatāpui, who was an academic at Victoria University. She said to me, we don't have any research on takatāpui, so you should do a PhD. I said, okay. How hard could it be? Turns out, it was a lot of work. But I called my thesis Part of the Whānau, the Emergence of Takatāpui Identity, He Whāriki. And I called it a whāriki, which is a woven mat. I called it that because I saw it as something we could put as a foundation into the house of well-being of takatāpui. So I'm very enamored of Mason Jury's framework of the whare, of the whare tapa, tapa kia ora, the whare tapa whā. So the four sides, taha whānau, our families, our connections, our the whānau we're born into, the whānau of our choosing, hine ngaro, our psychological well-being, our mental health, taha wairua, our spirituality, our connection with all things in the universe, and taha tinana, our bodily integrity. And I would think to myself, what would that look like? The house of well-being for Takatāpui, for rainbow people, what would it look like? What would we need to do to achieve it? And so in my thesis, I designed a whare Takatāpui, which was our house of well-being. And I imagined, I thought about it, that before the colonizers arrived, there was this whare. It was strong, it was open and welcoming to everybody, had beautiful carvings and tukutuku. We had posts that were holding up the house because it needed to be big to fit all of us. We had all our pictures on the wall. Our gardens were there. We had strong relationships. Our kids are running around. And then colonization comes along. And they throw stones on our roof. They make holes. The rain gets in, starts to make things rotten. They ripped out all of our carvings. They pulled down everything off the walls. They dug up, trampled on our gardens, and scared our people off. My belief, when I think about their whare, is that our ancestors saw them coming, and they had clues for us to find. They buried some of those carvings. They sent some of them around the world, trusting that we would come back and would find them. So I saw that my PhD, my research, since then and ever since, was to keep following the pathway of my ancestors, ask them for help, look for their clues, and I found them over and over again. And so I see the whare being rebuilt. The whariki that go on the floor, we use those for sleeping, we use those for having our talks. We had special ones for birthing, special ones for marriage, but there were special ones for when our warriors would stand on before they went out to fight. And so my whariki, my research, that's what I wanted to do. It's like, in that house, we will rebuild that house. I will dedicate my life to building that house. And so here my research was the whariki. We could sit down, talk together, make our decisions, make our plans, and we would stand there and we would go out to fight. But as we keep building our communities, every event like this that we have, the walls go back up, the roof gets fixed, it's watertight in their whare, and finally we can put the pictures up in the back of the hall, all of those who've passed. We don't know all of their names, we certainly don't know how they thought about themselves, but we know they are our ancestors, and we honour them. In this whare, we see the carvings going up, and we remember all of our kaitiaki, all our guardians, our tipua, all our shapeshifters, and our key ancestors, and we see them looking back at us, and they can finally talk to us, give us the advice and guidance that we need. I see our tukutuku panels being rewoven. And for when I think about tukutuku, I think particularly about Māori, about the life spark. So where wairua exists beyond death, our Māori is born and dies with us. And so I see the Māori in those intricate designs of tukutuku and beautiful patterns. That's where our stories are told. That's about what our principles are, what we're about. And I see this particularly in the well-being of our young people, because as we create these colours and vibrance, we know that many of our young people, their life spark fades, and sometimes it flickers out. And we must always, always make sure this house, this whare is always safe for them to come into. It's fun for them to come into so that they see themselves reflected on the walls. I want to talk about tapu, because the problem is when there is discrimination, the homophobia, the biphobia, the transphobia and the interphobia that is an interwoven part of colonization and all of its mechanisms that control most of the world, we all in some way suffer the historical trauma. As Māori, it affects us in a particular way as the people of this land, but all of the people who have come here as migrants, as refugees, as asylum seekers, in whatever way that your whānau have arrived, it impacts all of us, and particularly throughout our rainbow communities. And so I see in this whare that to the side, there's special healing spaces, because we need to take some personal responsibility to look after ourselves and face what it is that has caused the harm, but it's also our collective healing that needs to happen, and we do that together. We have places to be private and quiet that is reflective, and then in the whare, that's when we can talk about, as a people, as many peoples, how we continue to look after each other and the ways that we relate to each other, the ways we work together. And I think about tikanga. Tika is the right way to do things, but always, who decides what is right? How often in most spaces that we're in are we the ones deciding what's right? But in the whare, I see that collectively we talk about what are the rules, what are the processes, what are the policies, if we're going to write any, that determine how we are in the space, how do we keep it safe? Because tikanga is based on a value judgment of mātauranga. You decide based on what knowledge you have. And so part of my work then is contributing to the knowledge. So whenever all the places we're working in can say, oh, here's the evidence, here's the coming, counting ourselves research on trans and non-binary people, here is the thing that all of us try and create. Because in the whare, we say based on all this knowledge we have and thinking about what were the intentions of our tūpuna, because a lot of Māori culture is very highly gendered, why did our whānau do that? So how do we give honour, how do we honour that at the same time as we acknowledge the range of genders amongst us? And so I see that in this place, that together we create the ways of being. Mana, our prestige, authority, the respect, the way that we present, the way we are in the world. I have for a long time advocated that mana wahine was the basis of eliminating discrimination for people with diverse genders, sexualities and sex characteristics. I believed that by restoring the balance between men and women, that we would create a space then that would open up for our whānau who are trans, intersex and non-binary. I come from whare, which are huge, and they always have posts. And so I saw that there was these pō, one mana wahine, mana tāne, in this house, holding up the house. As I've continued on with my work, I've realized that's not enough. It cannot be left to those of us who are cisgendered, actually, to determine the place in this whare of those who are not. And so, and I would sit in my marae, thinking about these things, like looking around, feeling the space and saying, I actually asked my tūpuna, I was going, what's missing? What am I not seeing? And I realized what it was. Across the front, the top of the whare is the tāhuhu. It's the backbone of the ancestor. And I realized that there is mana tipua, because tipua were magical beings who could change gender and form. And I always say that I believe our trans, intersex and non-binary whānau are a form, modern-day embodiment of our tipua. And so I realised that was it. Here we are, mana wahine, mana tāne, the pō, but across here, collectively, we hold up the mana of the whare. Everything we do helps build that whare. And so I want to thank each of you for listening to me tonight and for the work that you do in your homes, in your communities, and in your places of worship. I want you to think about that whare. We can, you know, we haven't even gotten into the people that do all the cooking and the looking after and all the other things that need to happen to make a whare work. And all the parenting that needs to happen. But this is where I'm up to in my thinking with it. It's an evolving thing. But I want people to always think, because in that place, it honours the land that you're on here, but it brings everybody else in. We will all have a place. So here's to finding our place in the world and knowing, because of our wairua, why we're here and what we have to do. So, nō reira, tēnā koutou, kia ora koutou katoa.